My hair and pulled it very hard, and I was screaming for Tex to help me, or somebody to help me, and Frykowski, he was also screaming. Somehow he got behind me, and I had the knife in my right hand, and I don't know where I was at, but I was just swinging with the knife, and I remember hitting something 4-5 times repeatedly behind me. I didn't see what it was I was stabbing. Question. But did it appear to be a human being? Answer. I never stabbed a human being before, but I just know it was going into something. Question. Could it have been Frykowski? Answer. It could have been Frykowski. It could have been a chair. I don't know what it was. Susan had changed her story. In my interview with her, and on the tape, she had admitting to stabbing Frykowski 3 or 4 times in the leg. Also, if the story she told Virginia Graham was true, she knew exactly how it felt to stab someone, i.e. Gary Hinman. Frykowski ran for the front door, yelling for his life, for somebody to come help him. Tex got to him and hit him over the head several times with, I believe, a gun butt. Tex later told her that he had broken the gun hitting Frykowski and that it wouldn't work anymore. Although Frykowski had been shot twice, Susan couldn't recall the shooting, leaving in doubt exactly when this occurred. Apparently Tex had a knife ready as he began stabbing Frykowski as best he could because Frykowski was still fighting. Meanwhile, Abigail Folger had gotten loose from the rope and was in a fight with Katie, Patricia Krenwinkel. The foreman. We have a grand juror who would like to be excused for just a couple of minutes. A recess was taken. There was more than one pale face in the jury box. We resumed where Susan had left off. Someone was moaning, she said. Tex ran over to Sebring and bent down and viciously stabbed him in the back many times. Sharon Tate, I remember seeing her struggling with the rope. Tex ordered Susan to take care of her. Susan locked her arm around Sharon's neck, forcing her back onto the couch. She was begging for her life. I looked at her and said, "Woman, I have no mercy for you." And I knew that I was talking to myself, not to her. Question. Did Sharon say anything about the baby at that point? Answer. She said, "Please let me go. All I want to do is have my baby." There was a lot of confusion going on. Tex went over to help Katie. I saw Tex stab Abigail Folger, and just before he stabbed, maybe an instant before he stabbed her, she looked at him and let her arms go and looked at all of us and said, "I give up. Take me." I asked Susan how many times Tex had stabbed Abigail. "Only once," Susan replied. She grabbed her middle section of her body and fell to the floor. Tex then ran outside. Susan released her grip on Sharon but continued to guard her. When Tex returned, he told Susan, "Kill her." But according to the story Susan was now telling, I couldn't. Instead, in order to make a diversion so that Tex couldn't see that I couldn't kill her, I grabbed her hand and held her arms, and then I saw Tex stab her in the heart area around the chest. Sharon then fell from the couch to the floor. Susan only mentioned Tex stabbing Sharon Tate once. According to the autopsy report, she had been stabbed 16 times. According to Ronnie Howard, Susan told her, "I just kept stabbing her until she stopped screaming." The next thing she remembered, Susan now testified, was that she, Tex, and Katie were outside, and I saw Abigail Folger on the front lawn, bent over, falling onto the grass. I didn't see her go outside, and I saw Tex go over and stab her 3 or 4, I don't know how many times. Abigail Folger had 28 stab wounds. While he was doing that, Katie and I were looking for Linda because she wasn't around, and then Tex walked over to Frykowski and kicked him in the head. Frykowski was on the front lawn, away from the door. When Tex kicked him, the body didn't move very much. I believe it was dead at that time. which was not surprising, since Wojtek Frykowski had been shot twice, struck over the head 13 times with a blunt object, and stabbed 51 times. Then, Tex told me to go back into the house and write something on the door in one of the victim's blood. He said, "Write something that will shock the world." I had previously been involved in something similar to this, Hinman, where I saw "political piggy" written on the wall, so that stuck very heavily in my mind. Re-entering the house, she picked up the same towel she had used to tie Frykowski's hands and walked over to Sharon Tate. Then she heard sounds. Question: what kind of sounds were they? Answer: gurgling sounds, like blood flowing into the body out of the heart. Question: what did you do then? Answer: I picked up the towel and turned my head and touched her chest, and at the same time I saw she was pregnant, and I knew that there was a living being inside of that body, and I wanted to, but I didn't have the courage to go ahead and take it. And I got the towel with Sharon Tate's blood, walked over to the door, and with the towel I wrote "pig" on the door. Susan then threw the towel back into the living room. She didn't look to see where it landed. It fell on Sebring's face, hence the hood referred to in the press. Sadie, Tex, and Katie then picked up the bundles of spare clothing they'd hidden in the bushes. They left by the gate, Tex pushing the button, and hurried down the hill. When we got to the car, Linda Kasabian started the car, and Tex ran up to her and said, "What do you think you're doing? Get over on the passenger side. Don't do anything until I tell you to do it." Then we drove off. They changed clothing in the car, all except Linda, who, not having been in the house, had no blood on her. As they were driving away, Susan realized she had lost her knife, but Tex was against going back. They drove somewhere along Benedict Canyon, Mulholland Drive, I don't know which street, until we came to what looked like an embankment going down like a cliff with a mountain on one side and a cliff on the other. They pulled off and stopped, and Linda threw all the bloody clothes over the side of the hill. The weapons, the knives and gun, were tossed out at 3 or 4 different places. I don't remember how many. Susan then described, as she had to Virginia Graham and Ronnie Howard, how after they'd pulled off onto a side street and used a garden hose to wash off the blood, a man and a woman rushed out of the house and threatened to report them to the police. And Tex looked at him and said, "Gee, I'm sorry. I didn't think you were home. We were just walking around and wanted a drink of water. We didn't mean to wake you up or disturb you." And the man looked down the street and said, "Is that your car?" And Tex said, "No. I told you we were just walking." The man said, "I know that is your car. You better get in and get going." They got in the car, and the man, apparently having decided to detain them, reached in to get the keys. Tex quickly started the car, however, and drove off fast. After stopping at a service station on Sunset Boulevard, where they took turns going to the bathroom to check for any other blood spots, they drove back to Spawn Ranch, arriving there, Susan guessed, about 2 a.m. When they pulled up in front of the boardwalk of the old movie set, Charles Manson was waiting for them. He walked over to the car, leaned inside, and asked, "What are you doing home so early?" According to Susan, Tex told Manson basically just what we had done, that it all happened perfectly. There was a lot of... it happened very fast. A lot of panic, and he described it. Boy, it sure was helter-skelter. While at the service station, Susan had noticed blood on the door handles and steering wheel. She now went into the ranch kitchen and got a rag and a sponge and wiped it off. Question: how was Charles Manson acting when you arrived back at Spawn Ranch? Answer: Charles Manson changes from second to second. He can be anybody he wants to be. He can put on any face he wants to put on at any given moment. Patricia was very silent. Tex was nervous, like he had just been through a traumatic experience. Question: how did you feel about what you had just done? Answer: I almost passed out. I felt as though I had killed myself. I felt dead. I feel dead now. After she'd finished cleaning the car, Susan and the others had gone to bed. She thought she had made love to someone, maybe Clem, but then again maybe she had imagined it. The noon recess was called. Throughout her testimony, Susan had referred to the victims by name. After the recess, I established that she hadn't known their names that night, nor had she ever seen any of them before. When I first saw them, my reaction was, "Wow, they sure are beautiful people." Susan first learned their identities the day after the murders, while watching the news on TV in the trailer next to George Spahn's house. Tex, Katie, and Clem were also there, and maybe Linda, though Susan wasn't sure. Question. As you were watching the television news coverage, did anyone say anything? Someone, Susan thought the words came from her own mouth, but she wasn't positive, said either, "The soul sure did pick a Lulu," or "The soul sure did a good job." She did remember saying that what had happened had served its purpose. "Which was?" I asked. Answer, "To instill fear into the establishment." I asked Susan if any other members of the family knew they had committed the Tate murders. Answer, "The family was so much together that nothing ever had to be said. We all just knew what each other would do or had done." We came now to the second night, the evening of August 9th, and the early morning hours of August 10th. That evening, Manson again told Susan to get an extra set of clothing. I looked at him, and I knew what he wanted me to do, and I gave a sort of sigh and went and did what he asked me to do. Question. "Did he say what you were going to go out and do that night?" I asked. Answer. "He said we were going to go out and do the same thing we did the last night, only two different houses." It was the same car and the same cast. Susan, Katie, Linda, and Tex, with three additions. Charlie, Clem, and Leslie. Susan didn't notice any knives, only a gun, which Charlie had. They stopped in front of a house, somewhere in Pasadena, I believe. Charlie got out, and the others drove around the block, then came back and picked him up. He said he saw pictures of children through the window, and he didn't want to do that house. In the future, however, Manson explained, they might have to kill the children also. They stopped in front of another house, but saw some people nearby, so remained in the car, and after a few minutes drove off. At some point Susan fell asleep, she said. When she awakened, they were in a familiar neighborhood, near a house where, about a year before, she, Charlie, and about 15 others had gone to an LSD party. The house had been occupied by a Harold. She couldn't recall his last name. Charlie got out, only he didn't walk up the driveway of this particular house, but the one next door. Susan went back to sleep. She woke up when Charlie returned. He said, "Tex, Katie, Leslie, go into the house. I have the people tied up. They are very calm." He said something to the effect that last night Tex let the people know they were going to be killed, which caused panic, and Charlie said that he reassured the people with smiles in a very quiet manner that they were not to be harmed. And so Tex, Leslie, and Katie got out of the car. Susan ID'd photographs of Tex, Leslie, and Katie, also of the LaBianca residence, the long driveway, and the house next door. I asked Susan what else Charlie told the trio. She replied that she thought, but it may be my imagination that tells me this, that Charlie instructed them to go in and kill them. She did recall him saying that they were to paint a picture more gruesome than anybody had ever seen. He'd also told them that after they were done, they were to hitchhike back to the ranch. When Charlie returned to the car, he had a woman's wallet with him. Then they drove around in a predominantly colored area. Question. What happened next? Susan said they stopped at a gas station. Then Charlie gave Linda Kasabian the woman's wallet and told her to put it in the bathroom in the gas station and leave it there, hoping that somebody would find it and use the credit cards and thus be identified with the murder. I wondered about that wallet. To date, none of Rosemary LaBianca's credit cards had been used. After leaving the station, Susan said she went back to sleep. It was like I was drugged, though I was not on drugs at the time. When she woke up, they were back at the ranch. At this time, we were unaware that Susan Atkins had made some significant omissions in her grand jury testimony, including three other attempts at murder that night. Had we known of them, we probably would have asked for an indictment of Clem. As it was, however, all we had against him was Susan's statement that he had been in the car. And we still had a slim hope that his brother, whom we'd contacted at the Highway Patrol Academy, might persuade him to cooperate with us. Susan had not entered the LaBianca residence. However, the next morning, Katie told her what had happened inside. Answer. She told me that when they got in the house, they took the woman in the bedroom and put her on the bed and left Tex in the living room with the man. And then Katie said the woman heard her husband being killed and started to scream, "What are you doing to my husband?" And Katie said that she then proceeded to stab the woman. Question. Did she say what Leslie was doing while... Answer. Leslie was helping Katie hold the woman down because the woman was fighting all the way up until she died. Later, Katie told Susan that the last words the woman spoke, "What are you doing to my husband?" would be the thought she would carry with her into infinity. Afterwards, Katie told Susan, they wrote "Death to all pigs" on the refrigerator door or on the front door, and I think she said they wrote "Helter Skelter" and "Arise." Then Katie walked into the living room from the kitchen with a fork in her hand, and she looked at the man's stomach, and she had the fork in her hand, and she put the fork in the man's stomach and watched it wobble back and forth. She said she was fascinated by it. Susan also said that it was Katie, I believe, who carved the word "war" on the man's stomach. The three then took a shower, and since they were hungry, they went to the kitchen and fixed themselves something to eat. According to Susan, Katie also told her that they presumed the couple had children and that they would probably find the bodies when they came over for Sunday dinner later that day. After leaving the residence, they dumped the old clothing in a garbage can a few blocks, maybe a mile away from the house. Then they hitchhiked back to Spahn Ranch, arriving about dawn. I had only a few more questions for Susan Atkins. Question. Susan, did Charlie oftentimes use the word "pig" or "pigs"? Answer, yes. Question, how about "Helter Skelter"? Answer, yes. Question, did he use the words "pigs" and "Helter Skelter" very, very frequently? Answer, well, Charlie talks a lot. In some of the songs he wrote, "Helter Skelter" was in them, and he'd talk about "Helter Skelter." We all talked about "Helter Skelter." Question. You say "we." Are you speaking of the family? Answer. Yes. Question. What did the word "pig" or "pigs" mean to you and your family? Answer. Pig was a word used to describe the establishment. But you must understand that all words had no meanings to us, and that "Helter Skelter" was explained to me. Question. By whom? Answer. Charlie. I don't even like to say Charlie. I'd like to say the words came from his mouth, that "Helter Skelter" was to be the last war on the face of the earth. It would be all the wars that have ever been fought built one on top of the other, something that no man could conceive of in his imagination. You can't conceive of what it would be like to see every man judge himself and then take it out on every other man all over the face of the earth. After a few more questions, I brought Susan Atkins' testimony to an end. As she nonchalantly stepped down from the witness stand, the jurors stared at her in disbelief. Not once had she shown a trace of remorse, sorrow, or guilt. There were only four more witnesses that day. After Susan Atkins was taken from the room, Wilfred Parent was brought in to identify his son in a high school prom picture. After identifying photos of the other Tate victims, Winifred Chapman testified that she had washed the front door of the Tate residence shortly before noon on Friday, August 8th. This was important, since it meant that in order to leave a print, Charles Tex Watson had to have been on the premises sometime after Mrs. Chapman left at 4 that afternoon. Aaron questioned Terry Melcher. He described meeting Manson, told of how Manson had been along when Dennis Wilson drove him home to 10,050 Cielo Drive one night, and described, very briefly, his two visits to Spawn Ranch, the first to audition Manson, the second to introduce him to Michael Deasy, who had a mobile recording unit and who he felt might be more interested in recording Manson than he was. Manson gave Deasy some LSD. He had such a frightening trip that he wanted nothing more to do with Manson or his family. According to various family members, Melcher had made numerous promises to Manson and hadn't come through on them. Melcher denied this. The first time he went to Spawn, he had given Manson $50, all the money he had in his pocket, because I felt sorry for these people. But it was for food, not an advance on a recording contract, and he'd made no promises. As for Manson's talent, he wasn't impressed enough to allot the time necessary to prepare and record him. I wanted to interview Melcher in depth. I had a feeling that he was withholding something, but like most of the other grand jury witnesses, he was here for a very limited purpose, and any real digging would have to wait. Los Angeles coroner Thomas Noguchi testified to the autopsy findings on the 5 Tate victims. When he had concluded, the session was adjourned until Monday. That the proceedings were secret encouraged speculation, which in some cases appeared not as conjecture but fact. The headline on the Los Angeles Herald Examiner that afternoon read, "Tate Killers Wild on LSD," grand jurors told. It wasn't true. Susan Atkins had stated the very opposite, that the killers were not on drugs either night. But the myth was born, and it persisted, perhaps because it was the easiest explanation for what had happened. Though, as I'd soon learn, drugs were one of several methods Manson used to obtain control over his followers, they had no part in these crimes, for a very simple reason. On these two nights of savage slaughter, Charles Manson wanted his assassins in complete control of their faculties. The reality and its implications were far more frightening than the myth. December 6th to 8th, 1969. On Saturday, Joe Granata went to the impound garage in Canoga Park to examine John Swartz's 1959 Ford, which had been held there since the August 16th Spawn raid. This was the car Susan Atkins said the killers had used on both nights. Granato got a positive benzidine reaction on a spot in the upper right-hand corner of the glove compartment, indicating blood, but there wasn't enough to determine whether it was animal or human. When I finally got Joe's written report, I noticed the blood wasn't mentioned. Asked about this, Joe said the amount was so small he hadn't bothered to note it. I had Joe prepare a new report, this time including reference to the blood. Our case thus far was basically circumstantial, and in such a case, each speck of evidence counts. "I just had a talk with Gary Fleischman, Vince," Aaron said. "He wants a deal for his client, Linda Kasabian. Complete immunity in exchange for her testimony at the trial. I told him maybe we could go along with her pleading to voluntary manslaughter, but we couldn't give her—" "Christ, Aaron," I interrupted. "It's bad enough that we had to give Susan Atkins something. Look at it this way. Krenwinkel's in Alabama, Watson's in Texas. For all we know, we may not be able to extradite them before the others go on trial, and Van Houten wasn't along on the night of the Tate murders. If we give deals to Atkins and Kasabian, who are we going to prosecute for the 5 Tate killings? Just Charlie? The people of this city won't tolerate that. They're shocked and outraged by these crimes. Drive through Bel Air sometime. The fear is still so real you can feel it." According to Fleischman, Linda was anxious to testify. He had urged her to fight extradition. She'd gone against his advice and come back to California because she wanted to tell the whole story. Okay. What can she testify to? According to Susan, Linda never entered either the Tate or LaBianca residences. As far as we know, she wasn't an eyewitness to any of the murders, with the possible exception of Stephen Parent. More important, as long as we have Susan, Linda's testimony would be valueless to us, since Susan and Linda are both accomplices. As you well know, the law is clear on this. The testimony of one accomplice can't be used to corroborate the testimony of another accomplice. What we really need, more than anything else, is corroboration. This was one of our biggest problems. In a sense, it didn't matter who ended up as our star witness. Without corroboration, our case would be lost as a matter of law. We not only had to find corroboration against each of the defendants, that corroborating evidence had to be completely independent of the accomplice's testimony. Aaron had seen Linda briefly when she was booked into Sybil Brand. I'd never seen her. For all I knew, she was probably just as freaky as Sadie Mae Glutz. Now, if Susan bolts back to Charlie, I told Aaron, and we're left without a major witness for the trial, as well we might be, then we can talk about a deal for Linda. In fact, if that happens, Linda may be our only hope. When the grand jury reconvened on Monday, we moved quickly through the remaining testimony. Sergeant Michael McGann described what he had found at 10,050 Cielo Drive on the morning of August 9, 1969. Sergeant Frank Escalante testified to having rolled Charles Watson's prints on April 23, 1969, when he was arrested on a drug charge. Jerome Bowen of SID described how he lifted the latent from the front door of the Tate residence, and Harold Dolan, also of SID, testified to having compared it to the Watson exemplar, finding 18 points of identity, 8 more than LAPD requires for a positive identification. Sergeant William Lee testified regarding the pieces of gun grip and the .22 caliber bullets. Edward Lomax of High Standard matched the grips with his firm's .22 caliber Longhorn revolver and gave statistics indicating that the gun itself, because of its low production figures, was rather unique. Greg Jacobson told of touting Manson to Melcher. Granado testified regarding the rope, the blood on the gun grips, and his discovery of the buck knife. It was, for the most part, highly technical testimony, and the appearance of Daniel DiCarlo provided a respite, as well as more than a little local color. Aaron asked Danny, "Did you have any particular reason for staying at the ranch?" Answer, "Lots of pretty girls up there." "How did he get along with particular girls? For example, Katie?" Answer, "We talked. That is about it, but I never did nothing. You know, I never snatched her up or anything." Question. "And is your motorcycle club the kind that goes into a town and scares everybody?" Answer. "No, that only happens in the movies." DiCarlo's appearance, however, was intended for more than comic relief. He testified that Manson, Watson, and others, including himself, target practiced with a .22 caliber buntline revolver at Spawn. He said that he had last seen the gun maybe a week, week and a half, before the 16th of August, and never after that. The drawing of the revolver, which he had made for LAPD before he knew it was the Tate murder weapon, was introduced into evidence. DiCarlo also recalled how he and Charlie had bought the 3-strand nylon rope, which, being an ex-Coast Guardsman he called Line, at the Jack Frost store in Santa Monica in June 1969, and shown the rope found at Cielo, said it was identical. After Susan Atkins, the outlaw motorcyclist looked almost like a model citizen. Deputy Medical Examiner David Katsuyama followed DiCarlo. Katsuyama had conducted the LaBianca autopsies. "I'd have many, many problems with this witness. The grand jury provided only a sample." Aaron was to show Katsuyama a photo of Lino LaBianca's hands, which were bound with a leather thong. DiCarlo was then to retake the stand and describe how Charlie always wore leather thongs around his neck. Sergeant Patchett was to follow and introduce the thongs he had found in Independence among Manson's personal effects. He was also prepared to testify that they were similar. Aaron showed Katsuyama the photo, asking what material had been used to tie Lino LaBianca's hands. "Electrical cord," he replied. I managed to suppress a groan. The electrical cord had been around the necks of the LaBianca victims. Would he look at the photo a little more closely? It still looked like electrical cord to him. I finally had to show Katsuyama his own autopsy notes, where he'd written, "The hands are tied together with a rather thin leather thong." Roxy Lucarelli, an officer with LAPD and a lifelong friend of Lino's, identified photos of the LaBiancas, both Suzanne and Frank Struthers being still too shaken by the deaths to testify. Sergeant Danny Galindo told what he had found at 3301 Waverly Drive the night of August 10th through 11th, 1969, and stated that a search of the residence revealed no trace of Rosemary LaBianca's wallet. Of the five girls brought down from Independence, Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy, refused to testify, and we had not called Leslie Van Houten since we were now aware that she was one of the LaBianca killers. The three remaining, Diane Lake, a.k.a. Snake, Nancy Pittman, a.k.a. Brenda, and Ruth Ann Morehouse, a.k.a. Uish, all denied any knowledge of the murders. I'd anticipated this. However, I had another reason for calling them. If they appeared as defense witnesses when we went to trial, any discrepancy between what they told the grand jury and the trial jury would give me a prior inconsistent statement with which to impeach their testimony. At 4:17 p.m., the Los Angeles County Grand Jury began their deliberations. Exactly 20 minutes later, they returned the following indictments. Leslie Van Houten, 2 counts of murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. Charles Manson, Charles Watson, Patricia Krenwinkle, Susan Atkins, and Linda Kasabian, 7 counts of murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. We'd got the indictments. And that was about all we had. December 9th to 12th, 1969. Neither Aaron nor I logged the calls we received, but it would be a safe guess that we were getting upward of 100 a day, to most of which our only response was no comment. The press was frantic. Although the indictments had been made public, the grand jury transcript itself had been sealed. It would remain secret until a week to 10 days after the last defendant was arraigned. It was rumored that one magazine offered $10,000 just to look at a copy. An officer, Thomas Drinan, called from Oregon. He had arrested Susan Atkins in 1966 as part of a hold-up gang. At the time, she had been carrying a 25-caliber pistol and had told Drinan that if he hadn't drawn first, she would have shot and killed him. At this stage of the investigation, such information had no relevance. There was always a chance, however, that it might be useful later, and I made a note of his name and telephone number. My cubicle in the Hall of Justice measured 20 feet by 10 feet, the furnishings consisting of a battered desk, a rickety cot brought in for catnaps at lunch hour, a filing cabinet, a couple of chairs, and a large table, usually piled high with transcripts and exhibits. A reporter once described the decor as 1930 Chicago. At that, I was lucky, since the other deputy DAs had to share their offices. When I had a witness to interview, I'd have to drive everyone else out, not always diplomatically. That left the phone, which, since none of us had secretaries, we had to answer ourselves. Each day brought new developments. Thus far, although sheriff's deputies had dug up a sizable portion of Spahn Ranch, no trace of the remains of Donald Shorty Shea had been found. However, acting on the information supplied by Mary Brunner, LASO searched the neighborhood adjacent to 20910 Gresham Street, Canoga Park, and found, just around the corner from the former family residence, Shea's 1962 Mercury. It was dirt-covered and rain-streaked, apparently having been abandoned some months before. Inside the vehicle was a footlocker containing Shea's personal effects. Dusting it, LASO found a set of palm prints, which were later matched to family member Bruce Davis. Shea's cowboy boots were also in the car. They were caked with dried blood. Independence, California, 4 p.m., December 9th. Charles Mills Manson, a.k.a. Jesus Christ, age 35, address, transient, occupation, musician, was charged with the Tate-LaBianca murders. Sartucci and Gutierrez were bringing him to Los Angeles. We scheduled Manson's arraignment on a different date than that of the other defendants, fearing that if Atkins and Manson met in a courtroom, he'd persuade her to repudiate her testimony. A reporter located Susan Atkins' father in San Jose. He said he didn't believe this claim that Susan was under the hypnotic spell of Manson. I think she is just trying to talk her way out of it. She's sick and she needs help. According to the reporter, Mr. Atkins blamed Susan's involvement on her use of drugs and the leniency of the courts. He said he'd tried for 3 years to get the courts to keep his rebellious daughter off the streets. Had they done so, he implied, this might not have happened. For Susan, I realized, the family was her only family. I understood now why Caballero felt it was only a matter of time before she returned to the fold. On December 10th, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, and Leslie Van Houten were brought before Judge William Keene. All three requested and were granted continuances before entering pleas. This was the first time I had seen Kasabian. She was short, about 5'1", with long dark blonde hair and green eyes, and was quite obviously pregnant. She looked older than 20. In contrast to Susan and Leslie, who smiled and giggled through most of the proceedings, Linda seemed on the edge of tears. Following the grand jury hearing, Judge Keene had called Aaron and me into chambers. At that time, he'd told us that since the DA's office was not discussing the case with the press, he saw no need to issue a publicity order, or, as it is most often called, a gag order covering the case. However, owing to the incredible amount of pretrial publicity, a New York Times reporter told me that already it far exceeded that given the first Sam Shepard trial, Judge Keene, without consulting our office, now went ahead and issued a detailed publicity order. Later amended several times, it would run to a dozen pages. In essence, it forbade anyone connected with the case, prosecutors, defense attorneys, police officers, witnesses, and so forth, to discuss the evidence with any representative of the media. Though unknown to me at the time, the order was already too late to prevent an inside account of the murders from making headlines around the world. The previous evening, attorney Richard Caballero, acting on the basis of an agreement with Susan Atkins, had arranged the sale of the publication rights to her story. Call from LAPD. Charles Koenig, an attendant at the Standard Service Station at 12881 Ensenada Boulevard in Sylmar, was cleaning the women's restroom when he noticed the toilet was running. Lifting the lid off the tank, he found on top of the mechanism, damp but above the waterline, a woman's wallet. He'd checked the driver's license and credit cards, saw the name Rosemary LaBianca, and immediately called LAPD. SID was checking the wallet for prints, but because of both the material and the dampness, they doubted they'd find any. Just the discovery of the wallet was enough for me, for it provided another piece of independent evidence supporting Susan Atkins' story. Apparently the wallet had been there undiscovered since Linda Kasabian placed it there the night of the LaBianca murders, exactly 4 months ago. At 11 a.m. on December 11th, buckskin-clad Charles Manson was brought before Judge William Keene. The courtroom was so packed with reporters and spectators you couldn't have squeezed another person in with a shoehorn. Since Manson lacked funds to hire an attorney, Keene appointed Paul Fitzgerald of the Public Defender's Office to represent him. I'd come up against Paul before on several jury trials and knew he had a good reputation in his office. Manson was arraigned and a postponement granted until December 22nd for the entering of his plea. In Independence, Sandra Good had told me that once, in the desert, Charlie had picked up a dead bird, breathed on it, and the bird had flown away. "Sure, Sandy, sure," I replied. Since then I'd heard a great deal about Manson's alleged powers. Susan Atkins, for example, felt he could see and hear everything she did or said. Midway through the arraignment, I looked at my watch. It had stopped. Odd. It was the first time I could remember that happening. Then I noticed that Manson was staring at me, a slight grin on his face. It was, I told myself, simply a coincidence. Following the arraignment, Paul Fitzgerald told Ron Einstoss, veteran crime reporter for the Los Angeles Times, "There's no case against Manson and these defendants. All the prosecution has are two fingerprints and Vince Bugliosi." Fitzgerald was right about our case being weak, but I didn't intend that it should remain that way. Nearly 3 weeks ago, I'd given the Tate detectives, Calkins and McGann, an initial list of things to do, among which were to interview Terry Melcher, check the prints of every known family member against the unmatched Tate latents, show photographs of family members to friends and relatives of the victims, determine if the glasses belong to anyone in the family. I called in Calkins and McGann and asked for a progress report. I learned that only one of the things on the list had been done. Melcher had been interviewed by the LaBianca detectives. To date, LAPD hadn't even begun looking for the Tate weapons and clothing, though Susan Atkins' statements gave us some good clues as to the general area where they should be. Arrangements were made through our office for Susan to be taken from Sybil Brand the following Sunday to see if she could point out the spots where Linda Kasabian had thrown the various items. Fitzgerald was not the only one who felt we had no case. The consensus in the DA's office and the Los Angeles legal community, which I picked up from many sources, usually with some such remark as, "Too bad you had to get involved in such a bummer," was that the case against Manson and most of the other defendants would be thrown out on an 1118 motion. Under Section 1118.1 of the California Penal Code, if at the end of the people's case the court feels the prosecution has failed to put on enough evidence to sustain a conviction on appeal, the judge is empowered to acquit the defendants. They aren't even required to put on a defense to the charges. Some felt it wouldn't even get that far. Newsweek quoted an unnamed Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney as saying that our case against Manson was so anemic that it would be thrown out even before we went to trial. Such talk, in addition to the national exposure that would be accorded any defense attorney connected with the case, was, I suspected, the reason Manson was having so many visitors at the Los Angeles County Jail. As one deputy sheriff put it, "It's like a bar association convention over here." Between December 11, 1969 and January 21, 1970, Manson had 237 separate visits, 139 of which were by one or more attorneys. Among the first lawyers to call on him were Ira Reiner, Day Shin, and Ronald Hughes, none of whom I knew at that time, though I'd know all three much better before the trial ended. Rumors multiplied like bacteria. One was that prior to the imposition of the gag order, Caballero had sold Atkins' story to a European press syndicate with the stipulation that the story was not to be released in the United States until after the grand jury transcript was made public. If true, I seriously doubted if American papers would respect such an agreement. There were bound to be leaks. December 14th. 1969. I didn't have to look for a newsstand that sold foreign papers. When I got up that Sunday morning, I needed only to walk out the front door, reach down, and pick up the Los Angeles Times. Susan Atkins' story of two nights of murder. The story covered nearly three pages, though obviously edited and rewritten with some additional material on her childhood. It was essentially the same story Susan Atkins had related on the tape made in Caballero's office. Not until the trial itself would the story behind the story come out. The following is reconstructed from the courtroom testimony. I can make no claim as to its accuracy, only that this is what the various participants testified under oath. Before the imposition of the gag order, Lawrence Schiller, a self-described Hollywood journalist and communicator, approached Richard Caballero and his law associate, Paul Caruso, asking if they would be interested in selling Susan Atkins' first-person account of the murders. After consulting with Susan, an agreement was reached and a ghost, Los Angeles Times reporter Jerry Cohen, on leave of absence from the paper, was hired to write the account. Schiller, though listed as co-author, not only didn't write the story, he never even met Susan Atkins. According to evidence introduced during the trial, the terms of the agreement were 25% to Schiller, of the remaining 75%, 60% to Susan Atkins, 40% to her attorneys. Using as his main source the December 1st tape, Cohen completed the story in just 2 days, while locked in a room in Schiller's home. To make sure he maintained exclusivity, Schiller saw that Cohen had neither carbon paper nor access to a phone, and he destroyed all but the finished draft. According to their subsequent courtroom testimony, Caballero and Caruso understood that initially the story was to appear in Europe only, with a publication date of Sunday, December 14th. According to Schiller, on December 12th he made 3 Xerox copies of the manuscript. One was given to Caballero, one to a German editor who had bought the rights for his magazine and who translated it as he flew back to Germany, and the third flown by special courier to the London News of the World, which had paid $40,000 for exclusive English rights. Schiller put the original in his own safe. The following day, Saturday, December 13th, Schiller learned, one, that the Los Angeles Times also had a Xerox copy of the manuscript, and two, that the Times intended to run it in full the following day. Screaming copyright infringement, Schiller tried unsuccessfully to stop publication. Exactly how the Los Angeles Times obtained the story remains unknown. During the trial, Caballero more than hinted that he suspected Schiller, while Schiller attempted to put the blame on Caballero. Whatever the ethics of the whole matter, the Atkins story created immense problems which would plague both the defense and the prosecution throughout the trial. The story was not only reprinted in newspapers all over the world. Even before the trial started, it appeared as a paperback book titled The Killing of Sharon Tate, published by New American Library, which is owned by the Times Mirror Company, which also owns the Los Angeles Times. It was felt by some that the Atkins revelations would make it impossible for the defendants to obtain a fair trial. Although neither Aaron nor I nor eventually the trial judge shared this view, we were all too aware from the moment the story broke that finding 12 jurors who hadn't read or heard of the account and then keeping any mention of it out of the courtroom itself would be a difficult task. Few of the Angelenos who read Susan Atkins' story in the Times that Sunday were aware that she was at the same time riding around Los Angeles and its environs in a nondescript, though heavily guarded, automobile. We were hoping she would point out the places where the clothing and weapons had been discarded following the Tate murders. On returning to Sybil Brand that night, Susan wrote a letter to a former cellmate, Kit Fletcher, in which she told of her excursion. "My attorney is great. He has had me out to his office twice, and today he got me out for 7 hours. We went riding in a car up to the Tate Mansion and through the canyons. The LAPD wanted me to see if I could recall where certain things happened. It was such a beautiful day. My memory vanished." As in most jails, the mail at Sybil Brand was censored, both letters received and letters sent being read by the authorities. Those which contained what appeared to be incriminating statements were photocopied and given to our office. Under existing case law, this could be done without violating a prisoner's constitutional rights. Susan, Sadie, was in a letter-writing mood. Several of her letters contained damaging admissions which, unlike her grand jury testimony, could be used against her in the trial, if we chose to do so. To Joe Stevenson, a friend in Michigan, she'd written on the 13th, "You remember the Sharon Tate murder and LaBianca murder? Well, because of my big mouth to a cellmate, they just indicted me and 5 other people. Even more incriminating and revealing was a kite Susan sent Ronnie Howard. In jail parlance, a kite is any illegal communication. The letter, which Susan smuggled to Ronnie via the underground at Sybil Brand, read as follows. I can see your side of this, clearly. Nor am I mad at you. I am hurt in a way, only I understand. I blame no one but myself for even saying anything to anybody about it. Yes, I wanted the world to know, M. It sure looks like they do now. There was a so-called motive behind all this. It was to instill fear into the pigs and to bring on Judgment Day, which is here now for all. In the word kill, the only thing that dies is the ego. All ego must die anyway, it is written. Yes, it could have been your house. It could have been my father's house also. In killing someone physically, you are only releasing the soul. Life has no boundaries, and death is only an illusion. If you can believe in the second coming of Christ, M is he who has come to save. Maybe this will help you to understand. I did not admit to being in the second house because I was not in the second house. I went before the grand jury because my attorney said your testimony was enough to convict me and all the others. He also said it was my only chance to save myself. Then I was out to save myself. I have gone through some changes since then. I know now it has all been perfect. Those people died not out of hate or anything ugly. I am not going to defend our beliefs. I am just telling you the way it is. As I write to you, I feel more at ease inside. When I first heard you were the informer, I wanted to slit your throat. Then I snapped that I was the real informer, and it was my throat I wanted to cut. Well, that's all over with now, as I let the past die away from my mind. You know it will all turn out okay in the end anyway, M or no M, Sadie or no Sadie. Love will still run forever. I am giving up me to become that love a little more every day. Quoting a lyric from one of Manson's songs, Susan ended the letter, "Cease to exist. Just come and say you love me. As I say I love you, or I should say I love me, my love, in you." I hope now you understand a little more. If not, ask. Ronnie, who was now living in deathly fear of Susan, turned the letter over to her attorney, Wesley Russell, who passed it on to our office. It would prove far more damaging to Susan Atkins than the confession which appeared in the Los Angeles Times. December 15th to 25th, 1969. When on a case, I made it a habit periodically to scour LAPD's tubs or files, often finding something useful to my case whose evidentiary value wasn't apparent to the police. In going through the LaBianca tubs, I made two discoveries. The first was the Al Springer interview. Only one page had been transcribed, the one on which Springer related how Manson told him, "We knocked off five of them just the other night." As desperate as we were for evidence, none of the detectives had mentioned the Springer statement to me, nor, when I questioned Lieutenants Helder and LePage, were they aware they had a confession by Manson in their files. I took the tape and had it transcribed, adding "Interview Al Springer" to my own already lengthy list of things to do. Though because of Aranda, Manson's confession couldn't be used against him at the trial, it was quite possible he had made other admissions that could. The second file was a photocopy of a letter mailed to Manson while he was in jail in Independence. The content was innocuous. However, it was signed Harold. Susan Atkins had told the grand jury that a guy named Harold had been living at the house next door to the LaBianca residence when she, Charlie, and a number of others had gone there for an LSD party a year or so earlier. I had a feeling this might be the same person, and made another note for the LaBianca detectives. Find Harold. This shouldn't be too difficult, as he had given an address in Sherman Oaks and two telephone numbers. Why? The biggest and most puzzling question of all remained. What was Manson's motive? On learning that Manson often told his followers that he was a Scorpio, and thinking that possibly his belief in astrology might be a factor, I obtained back copies of the Los Angeles Times and checked Carol Reiter's astrological forecast for his sign. August 8th. Do whatever you think will help you to extend your sphere of influence. Take care of that private task wisely and well. Get the information at the right source, then use it cleverly. August 9th. If you go about it tactfully, you can get a reluctant associate to understand what you have in mind. Cooperate with this individual when some problem arises. August 10th. There are fine opportunities all around you. Don't hesitate to seize the best one. Extend your sphere of influence. You could, I realized, read just about any meaning you wanted into such forecasts, including plans for murder. It was indicative of our desperation that I went to such unlikely lengths in trying to ascertain why Manson had ordered these murders. I didn't even know whether Manson read newspapers. Since the story first broke, LAPD had been receiving inquiries from various police departments regarding unsolved murders in their jurisdictions, which they believed could have been committed by one or more members of the Manson family. I went through these reports, eliminating a great many, setting others aside as possibles. These will be discussed in a later chapter. Though my principal concern was the Tate-LaBianca homicides, I wanted to see if there was a discernible pattern which might help explain the killings at Cielo and Waverly Drives. Thus far, if there was one, I couldn't find it. In her printed confession, Susan Atkins had described how, after changing clothes in the car, the Tate killers drove along a steep embankment with a mountain on one side, a ravine on the other. We stopped and Linda got out of the car and threw all the clothes, all drippy with blood, over the side. With the Times story on the seat beside them, a TV camera crew from Channel 7, KABC-TV, attempted to recreate the scene. Driving from the gate at 10,050 Cielo Drive, they proceeded down Benedict Canyon, all but the driver changing clothes on the way. It took them 6 minutes and 20 seconds, during which they later admitted they felt more than a little foolish, to complete their change of apparel. At the first spot where they could pull off the road, a wide shoulder opposite 2901 Benedict Canyon Road, they stopped and got out. Mountain on one side, ravine on the other. Newscaster Al Wyman looked down the steep embankment and, pointing to some dark objects about 50 feet down, said, laughing, "Looks like clothing down there." King Baggett, the cameraman, and Eddie Baker, the sound man, looked too and had to agree. It was just too easy. If the clothing was in plain view from the road, surely LAPD would have found it by now. Still, they decided to check it out. They were about to descend the slope when the car radio buzzed. They were needed on another story. While on the other assignment, they couldn't get those dark objects out of mind. About 3 p.m., they returned to the spot. Baker went down first, followed by Baggett. They found 3 sets of clothing. 1 pair of black trousers, 2 pairs of blue denim pants, 2 black t-shirts, 1 dark velour turtleneck, and 1 white t-shirt which was spotted with some substance that looked like dried blood. Some of the clothing was partly covered by dirt slides. All of it, however, was in an area about 12 feet square, as if thrown there in one bundle. They yelled the news up to Wyman, who called LAPD. By the time McGann and 3 other detectives arrived, shortly before 5, it was beginning to get dark, so the TV crew set up artificial lighting. While the detectives placed the clothing in plastic bags, Baggett filmed the incident. On learning of the find, I asked the Tate detectives to conduct a thorough search of the area to see if they could locate any of the weapons. I had to make the request not once but many, many times. In the interim, a week after the initial discovery, Baggett and Baker returned to the scene and conducted their own search, finding a knife. It was an old, badly rusted kitchen knife, which, because of its dimensions and dull edge, was eliminated as one of the murder weapons, but it was in plain view less than 100 feet from where the clothing had been found. That a TV crew had found the clothing was an embarrassment to LAPD. Faces at Parker Center, however, would be far redder before the end of the following day. On Tuesday, December 16th, Susan Atkins appeared before Judge Keene and pleaded not guilty to all 8 counts of the indictment.